to achieve clarity in photographing a standard letter-sized document. The film, lens, and shutter were housed in a single aluminum casing. As each picture was taken, the film automatically advanced to the next frame, up to 100. The assembly was closer to watchmaking than any commercial manufacturing process. Each one was fabricated individually, under a large magnifying glass. The supply was very limited. When the British Intelligence Service asked if they could borrow the blueprints to open a second supply line, the CIA agreed. But the camera was so complex, the British could not replicate it. The camera's small size forced designers to use an extremely thin film. The answer was found in retired stocks of an Eastman Kodak film once made for spy satellites, sliced and wound into the miniature enclosure. After some technical problems with loading the film, the CIA developed a second-generation camera, the T-50, which had 50 exposures. With this camera, the agent would not have to fuss with changing film. He would just use the device and return it. For Ogorodnik, a luxury fountain pen was selected as the concealment, with the camera tucked inside. To photograph a document, Ogorodnik was trained to position his elbows on the table, hands together, and aim the pen down toward the document. 11 inches from the page was the perfect distance. The camera was called the Tropel, after the Rochester, New York company that made it for the CIA, and the camera worked splendidly in the mid-1970s for Ogorodnik. When Tolkachev began spying in early 1979, the CIA was reluctant to give him the elegant little Tropel. Tolkachev was a new agent, untrained and untested. Instead, they gave him the Molly. It was about the size of a matchbox, based on the Minox, built by a contractor to the CIA specifications and named after the contractor's daughter. The one given to Tolkachev bore the serial number 018 and came with a separate light meter. The film was wound into special cassettes, each about 80 exposures, packaged in boxes. By April, Tolkachev reported to the CIA he was having trouble with the Molly. He realized it was dated. "Having familiarized myself with the camera, I was somewhat disappointed. Possibly this is tied in with my having more optimistic notions concerning the development of technology in this field," he wrote to the CIA. In response, headquarters decided to give Tolkachev the 35mm camera, the Pentax, and the clamp, which Gilcher passed to Tolkachev on June 6th. The Pentax wasn't obviously spy equipment. It was in use all over the world, and probably would not look entirely out of place if found in the apartment of a Soviet engineer. With the Pentax and the clamp, there was a good chance that Tolkachev's photography would not suffer from blurs or shake. As tradecraft, it dated back to at least World War II, when a spy for Germany had used a Leica 35mm camera, held in place with a makeshift clamp, to photograph documents. The CIA pondered whether to also give Tolkachev the sophisticated Tropel cameras. In the end, headquarters decided to offer him 2 Tropels, but with the caution that they were only for testing at home. He should not risk taking them to the office. In Moscow, Gilcher juggled these demands and uncertainties. He approved the plan to give Tolkachev the Tropel cameras, but insisted that headquarters send to Moscow written instructions for using them in Russian. The camera came in different sorts of concealments, a pen, a key fob, and a lipstick. It was important to make sure Tolkachev agreed in advance on the concealment, and that it not look out of place with other things in his coat pocket. Tolkachev had told them he normally carried a pen and keys. Everything had to be just right. The Tropel camera could be a death warrant if discovered by the KGB. It had no purpose other than espionage. 2 of the miniature Tropel cameras were in the package Gilcher handed to Tolkachev when they met again on October 15, 1979. One camera was red and the other black, so that Tolkachev and the CIA could keep track. Each was preloaded with 120 frames of film, and concealed in a pen for testing at home. When they met, Gilscher sensed that Tolkachev was irritated about something else. More than 4 months had passed since they had seen each other. Tolkachev complained that his request for a suicide pill, made in the spring, had been ignored for half a year. Tolkachev pressed Gilscher, saying he wanted it soon. Tolkachev described to Gilscher an incident in which the driver of a Moscow trolley bus had slammed on the brakes to avoid an accident, causing passengers to fall and seriously injuring some of them. He reminded Gilscher that he regularly took the bus and the streetcar with secret documents in his coat. What if that happened to him? Tolkachev promised he would carry the suicide pill with him only when he had secret documents on his person. The rest of the time, he would hide it at home. He promised it would be only a last resort. He did not want to face the ordeal of interrogation and trial. If caught, he wanted to take his own life. Tolkachev said he didn't want to waste precious moments talking about finances, but he had written out a reply to the CIA in an ops note. Gilscher put the note in his pocket. The next morning, back in the Moscow station, Gilscher opened Tolkachev's note. After a few pages, he reached item number 7, concerning finances, and saw trouble. The last financial proposals passed to me in June did not enthuse me, Tolkachev wrote. These proposals sharply deviate from my desires, communicated in one of the notes. When I wrote about the remuneration of Belenko, like about the sum with 6 digits, I was inaccurate, since I had in mind not a figure with 6 digits, but a number with 6 zeros. According to the information available to me, his sum was equal to $6 million. Gilscher had read and translated all of Tolkachev's handwritten notes since his first days in the Moscow station. He had met with Tolkachev 4 times and felt he understood him. Yet there were moments when he was floored. Tolkachev wanted millions of dollars? He read on. Sometimes it appears to me that, in the matter of finances, a definite tactic is employed against me, Tolkachev complained. I understand the gradual approach in the question of finances, which you are carrying out with me. However, in order that your tactics in this matter not create stoppages or delays in the passage of information, and would not bring about irreversible negative consequences, I would like you to take into consideration the following factors when examining my financial position. Tolkachev wrote with a strong hand and underlined the words about negative consequences. My basic goal in working with you, Tolkachev went on, consists of passing you the maximum amount of information in the shortest time. I do not limit myself to the passage of information on documents that have direct bearing on my work, but I actively seek out new important documents and try to receive access to them in order to make photocopies. As you are aware, I started working with you voluntarily. In order to establish contact, from the moment the first note was passed until the first meeting, exactly 2 years was required. During these 2 years, I trained myself to accept the idea of the possible consequences of my actions. Today, just as before, I understood that the end may come at any moment, but it does not frighten me, and I will work to the end. However, I will not always work only on a voluntary basis. Again, Gilscher saw the heavy underline. If I see that some game is being played with me, or that I am being pressured, then I will cease my cooperation. Besides, I understand perfectly that I will only be able to end my cooperation by committing suicide. Tolkachev was ratcheting up the pressure with a threat to quit, but he was vaguely suggesting that if he did quit, he would face so many uncertainties, such as arrest by the KGB, that he would have no choice but to commit suicide on his own. I wrote about my approach to finances sincerely and openly. I hope that you will answer me in the same spirit, I will not be discouraged by any answer from you. I suppose, Tolkachev said, that several million dollars is not too fantastic a price for such information. In the weeks that followed, the CIA wrestled with Tolkachev's demand for millions of dollars. They wondered if he was bluffing. Gilshar sensed that they had reached a delicate moment. The response to Tolkachev had to impress him, but could not be the sums he demanded. The CIA had never paid an agent on that scale. On November 16th, Gilshar and Hathaway sent a message to headquarters, pondering how to respond to Tolkachev. Perhaps they should challenge why he had escalated his demands from hundreds of thousands of dollars to millions, or just act surprised. In the end, they thought it best not to antagonize Tolkachev, but rather to chalk it up to complete misunderstanding and try to work it out. The CIA knew that Tolkachev was right. Several million dollars was not too fantastic a price for the espionage he was carrying out, looting the crown jewels of Soviet military research. But they just could not pay him that much, primarily because they feared he would flaunt it and jeopardize his own security. On December 12th, Kolaris, the division chief, wrote to Turner about the need to resolve the six zeros problem. His memo offered a revealing glimpse of how important the Tolkachev operation had become. As you are aware, Kolaris told the director, I have been involved in this operation since the beginning. We have never had another case like it in SE Division. Kolaris said the division was trying to follow operational rules they had developed from running earlier spies, but Tolkachev stood out as unique. In the earlier operations, such as Popov, Penkovsky, and Polyakov, the agents volunteered and largely functioned outside the Soviet Union. Tolkachev, however, was spying right in the heart of Moscow. Kolaris also reminded Turner of Tolkachev's stubborn drive to establish contact with the CIA and described Tolkachev as a mature, low-profile man, compared with more youthful and exuberant agents they had dealt with. We still are not certain what motivated Sphere to seek us out and work for us, Kolaris said. Our best reading at this time is that he is inspired by vengeance. Up to this point, and for the foreseeable future, the division intends to treat this case with extreme caution, because the chances of being taken for a ride are high. But he also wrote, Tolkachev has produced some extremely high-quality intelligence, which is already impacting on our Air Force, and he has promised more for the future. The stakes were high. But Kolaris noted that the disagreements over money were creating serious doubts about us in Sphere's mind. Kolaris recommended that the CIA make a payment so generous that Tolkachev's doubts would be erased. 300,000 rubles, or about $92,000 at the December meeting. I think it is important to demonstrate to him that we are not always going to nickel and dime him, Kolaris wrote. He added that while the money should be delivered as proof of good faith, Tolkachev would have to be warned again about the high risks he will be running by the mere possession of such a large amount. Still, meeting his specific monetary request for the first time in toto will provide a good foundation to talk about the future. Then Kolaris moved gingerly to the more difficult question. Sphere has asked for $10 million, more or less, over the next 10 years, he wrote. We have not agreed to that, and I propose that we do not agree to any such amount at this time. Instead, Kolaris proposed to leave things somewhat vague. The CIA could point to the 300,000 rubles and tell Tolkachev, we will commit ourselves to pay him properly in the future, but the size of the payment will depend on our evaluation of the product. He added, I think we should add that if he produces what he has promised, our estimate is that the material will be valued in the seven figures area. I would say no more than that. Having talked about a seven-figure amount allows us to raise once again the idea of an escrow account for security reasons, Kolaris said. If he balks, as I think he will, to the suggestion of an escrow account, we can ask him to think about the possibility of leaving the USSR with our help. This was a brand new wrinkle. Kolaris informed Turner that the CIA would not have to actually commit itself to exfiltration, smuggling the agent out of the country. They could just gently suggest it. Although Kolaris didn't say so, the CIA had never before carried out a successful exfiltration from Moscow. Kolaris said he didn't know if Tolkachev had thought of leaving or would be interested. But there was another benefit of talking about it. It might help dissuade Tolkachev from the suicide pill. "We want him to live and enjoy the fruits of his labor," Kolaris wrote. "If he insists again that he wants the pill and will not accept no as an answer, we can agree in principle. We can delay delivery by almost a year by asking for his recommendations for appropriate concealment devices, etc." Charles Battaglia, an assistant who was close to Turner, was in the office when Tolkachev's demands for a big payment came up for discussion with the director. In Turner's mind, human agents were fallible and unpredictable, and this one was asking for millions of dollars. "I will never forget the look on Turner's face," Battaglia recalled. "He gulped. And then he gave a green light." On December 15th, headquarters sent word to the Moscow station that "we have received the go-ahead from the director to give Tolkachev 300,000 rubles at the next meeting, as proof of our good faith and the value we place on the information he has provided." Headquarters cautioned that Tolkachev cannot realistically expect us to commit ourselves to a specific dollar amount for his future product, although if he produces what he has promised us, it may be valued totally in the area of seven figures. "We fully intend to pay him properly in the future, but we will decide the size of each payment," the cable said, "based on the value of the information to us." In fact, the value of Tolkachev's intelligence to the U.S. military and intelligence agencies was soaring, already considered to be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. But CIA headquarters did not want to reveal this to Tolkachev. They needed to find a way to impress him, to show that his espionage was prized, while not forking over millions of dollars. The plan was to deliver a very impressive brick of rubles. 300,000 would seem large enough to a Soviet engineer whose monthly salary was 350 rubles. The value was much less, however, than the $300,000 approved for Tolkachev at headquarters 7 months earlier. Gilscher, who would deliver the cash, was instructed to ask again about paying Tolkachev in precious stones or valuables, or with deposits in an escrow account in the West. Gilscher was also instructed to suggest the CIA would work out a plan for Tolkachev to escape the Soviet Union, a promise of exfiltration sometime in the future, not immediately. On the sticky question of the suicide pill, Gilscher was told to keep stalling and attempt to discourage Tolkachev. This was the demand that Tolkachev felt strongest about, yet headquarters was most reluctant to meet. "You may tell C.K. Sphere that we are seriously considering his request," headquarters told Gilscher, "but still feel he would be making a mistake in having this item in his possession." Chapter 8. Windfalls and Hazards. In sub-freezing cold, walking for 20 minutes in a vacant lot by some old garages, Gilscher met Tolkachev for the fifth time on December 27, 1979. Tolkachev was in a good mood and seemed glad to see Gilscher again. He had threatened to stop spying for the CIA in his October letter, but Gilscher realized right away that Tolkachev had done just the opposite. He was working with more energy and determination than ever. As they strolled, Tolkachev slipped a package to Gilscher. Inside were five electronic components from a Soviet radar, and a line diagram with each. Tolkachev told Gilscher they were left over from the time when I worked on experiments, finalizing the RP-23 complex. This was the radar the CIA had described as being of utmost value earlier in the year. The electronic components were an intelligence windfall that would help the United States determine how Soviet radars and avionics worked and build countermeasures to blind them. Tolkachev also gave Gilscher 81 rolls of exposed 35mm film, carrying hundreds of pages of secret documents. The Pentax camera had jammed and wouldn't advance the film, so he returned it to Gilscher, asking for two replacements. As they walked, Gilscher handed Tolkachev a package with four miniature Tropel spy cameras for the months ahead. Color-coded. Blue, gold, silver, and green. Tolkachev returned to Gilscher the red and black Tropels he had been given in October for testing, with exposed film inside. Gilscher, who had taken a briefcase with him, handed Tolkachev the big brick of cash, 150,000 rubles. The CIA had obtained the bills from a banker in Switzerland, so they could not be traced to the United States. It was only half the amount that Kolaris had suggested, but the impact was immediate. Tolkachev was pleased by the money and said it was in line with the value of his work, not the paltry 5,000 rubles he'd been given at meetings earlier that year. Tolkachev said he didn't really need the money and would probably just stash it away somewhere. Then he confessed to Gilscher that his demand for millions of dollars was not realistic and not meant to be taken literally. Gilscher again raised the possibility of an escrow account in the West. This time, Tolkachev didn't reject it out of hand. Very carefully, Gilscher brought up a possible exfiltration. Tolkachev brushed it off. He said he would never even consider it. Tolkachev brought some worrisome news. The procedures for handling secret documents in his office had tightened. Previously, he could check out classified reports from the First Department by signing for them on a permission sheet that remained on file with the department. At lunchtime, he could conceal the documents in his coat, leave the building, photograph them at home when he was alone, return to the institute after lunch, and put the documents back. At the main gate, where he showed his building pass, they would rarely check whether he was carrying anything. Now, Tolkachev said, in order to check out documents from the First Department, he was required to leave his building pass with the clerks in that department. Without the pass, he could not leave the building at lunch, nor photograph secret documents at home. The only documents he might be able to take home were less sensitive technical journals. Tolkachev boasted to Gilscher he had beat the system. He pulled a ruse on December 24th. And slipped some top-secret documents out of the building. He photographed them in his apartment. But he was facing a big setback. His usual habit of just walking out with documents in his coat pocket was not going to be possible. Tolkachev sternly reminded Gilscher of his still unfulfilled demand for the suicide pill. He felt he was in more danger. He had been signing out documents that were clearly not related to his current work. If questions about a leak were raised, his signatures were all over the permission sheet. He implored Gilscher to get the suicide pill. No more delays. Before parting, Gilscher surprised Tolkachev. As a gift for the holidays, Gilscher brought him two books by dissidents that were unavailable in Moscow, including one by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who had been exiled from the Soviet Union in 1974. Despite all that had happened that year, Gilscher reported Tolkachev was delighted. As they parted, Gilscher walked away from the vacant lot, and Tolkachev abruptly came running back in his direction. Gilscher was startled and feared that he was about to be ambushed. But Tolkachev caught up to him and explained that he had written an ops note and forgotten to give it to him. He handed the note to Gilscher and slipped away into the night. Back in the station, Gilscher read the ops note. Tolkachev insisted that the suicide pill was becoming more essential for me. He told Gilscher that he felt increasingly vulnerable to unforeseen circumstances, perhaps even a leak from the United States. Then he explained that every time he took a document from the First Department, he signed the permission sheet with his last name and signature. It was on file if the KGB ever decided to investigate. He wrote, "The number of documents drawn by me greatly exceeds my productive needs. For example, I will never be able to explain why I needed the technical descriptions of the AVM RLS RP23, N003, N006, N005. This is also hard to explain because our laboratory has stopped overseeing the RLS RP23, N003, N006 in September 1978, and our laboratory was never even involved in issuing the documentation for the RLS N005 or its serial introduction. The listed considerations induce me, already for the third time, to turn to you with the request that I be passed the means of self-destruction at once." Behind the codes and numbers in Tolkachev's note lay an astounding intelligence take. He had provided the United States with blueprints for several of the most modern radars then being developed and installed on Soviet interceptors and fighter planes. In December, the Defense Department told the CIA in a memorandum that as a result of Tolkachev's trove of documents, the Air Force had completely reversed its direction on a $70 million electronics package for one of the latest U.S. fighters. But Gilscher could see a larger crisis looming. Tolkachev had signed out so many documents, he had left a roadmap of his own treachery. That permission sheet could wreck the whole operation. And now, Tolkachev's easy method of copying documents at home at lunchtime was imperiled by the new restrictions, requiring him to turn in his building pass. For 2.5 years, Gus Hathaway had fought hard to keep the lights on in the Moscow station. He pushed back against Turner in the stand-down. He insisted that Tolkachev was genuine. He brought Gilscher to Moscow. He stood guard against KGB intruders during the embassy fire. He suffered through the loss of Ogorodnik and Kulak, but knew that losing an agent was a constant risk in the battle against the KGB. Hathaway eventually got the Moscow station back into spy operations, and even with setbacks, the CIA had come a long way since the paralysis of the 1960s, when there hadn't been an agent in Moscow worth talking about. Hathaway was preparing to end his tour and return to headquarters to become chief of the Soviet division, but his last weeks in the Moscow station were filled with anxiety. In late December 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, setting off a new period of tension with the West. The decade of detente was over. The SALT II treaty was shelved in the Senate. A new European arms race got underway, and the United States threatened to boycott the upcoming Moscow Olympics. For the Moscow station, the Afghan invasion meant trouble. Hathaway warned headquarters on January 9, 1980, that the KGB would intensify surveillance on the streets. Having come so far with Tolkachev, he was determined not to lose him and vowed to step up security measures in the deteriorating political situation. He said the CIA station would monitor electronically all known and suspect surveillance frequencies on days when they were planning to meet Tolkachev. They would also pay special attention to the surveillance around the embassy and keep watch on Tolkachev's apartment windows for signs of activity. Tolkachev's words to Gilscher and his letter in late December, describing the new security procedures at his institute, warning of his vulnerability for having signed out so many documents, and his ruse to steal more, worried headquarters. "Chilling," observed one headquarters cable. The new security restrictions preventing Tolkachev from taking documents home to photograph might prompt him to take an even bigger risk the CIA feared, such as sneaking the tiny Tropel cameras into his office. Already, Hathaway and Gilscher realized Tolkachev was ignoring their plea to be careful. They needed to do something that would strengthen his confidence and their sway. On January 8th, they wrote to headquarters, insisting it was time to give Tolkachev the L pill that he so often demanded. They hoped it would reassure Tolkachev the CIA was paying attention to his needs. Tolkachev's appeal for the suicide pill the previous month made valid points and draws logical conclusions, they told headquarters. Tolkachev was right to feel vulnerable, they added. His security situation was worsening because of his own tendency to overproduce, to take out documents without a justifiable cover, and to carry them home. Gilshier and Hathaway told headquarters, CK's fear is not heeding our requests to proceed slowly and is charging ahead, following his desire to pass the maximum amount of materials in the shortest period of time. They were not surprised by his willingness to commit suicide for a cause, they wrote. He is apparently following course of action inculcated in every Russian citizen from childhood, i.e., it is glorious, courageous, and manly to make the ultimate sacrifice for the motherland. There is no immoral connotation to making courageous and glorious decision to end one's life while fighting for the cause. CK's fear's cause is to do the greatest damage to the Soviet authorities that he possibly can. Gilshier and Hathaway recalled that Tolkachev calmly and logically promised that he has the control and willpower to refrain from using the L pill until the very last moment. They reminded headquarters that if compromised, Tolkachev would certainly face KGB interrogation, trial, and execution. We must re-examine his request for a suicide pill, they wrote. The question was taken to Turner, the CIA director, on January 17, 1980, in a memorandum carried by hand to his seventh-floor office. It was signed by Warren E. Frank, who was acting chief of the Soviet division until Hathaway arrived. In his memo, Frank predicted that Tolkachev will probably continue to press hard for the suicide pill, and he offered an excerpt of Tolkachev's note in December, saying the suicide pill was becoming more essential for me. The Moscow station had made a strong appeal for the L pill, but it was watered down by Frank before reaching Turner. Frank proposed that Gilshier make another effort to persuade Tolkachev of the inadvisability of having an L pill. Gilshier had already done this. Frank laid out four talking points that Gilshier could use in talking with the rest of agent. Gilshier had already received similar talking points from headquarters 8 months earlier. However, in this list, a new point was included. The director of our organization has very strong personal reservations on both moral and operational grounds against the issuance of this capability. The Moscow station wanted a clear and straightforward decision to give Tolkachev what he demanded. Instead, headquarters responded with fog and caution. Frank proposed giving the spy a vague promise the CIA would deliver the L pill later. This was another way to stall. Even if Turner approved the L pill in February, Frank suggested, we will still easily be able to defer the issuance of the pill until winter of this year, based on the summer hiatus as well as manufacturing and concealment delays. Frank's memo asked for Turner's approval for what was essentially a compromise, a vague promise to provide the pill someday, but only if Tolkachev continues to feel it is necessary. Turner was unhappy with all of it. As Frank had written, Turner opposed the L pill on both moral and operational grounds, and on the memo he scribbled the operational reasons. We are concerned in part from experience that availability of L pills can encourage an agent to take risks that are not prudent. He also wrote, the KGB is well aware of our distribution of L pills to an agent and would doubtless be thorough in searching. At the bottom of the memo, the division had typewritten approved with a space for Turner's signature. On January 24th, Turner wrote not in front of approved and said Gilshier should keep stalling and attempt once again to dissuade Tolkachev. Do not make commitment on this exchange. Stan. Gilshar and Hathaway were sorely disappointed. Gilshar felt he understood Tolkachev's thinking and feared an angry reaction. He archly reminded headquarters that talking points had already been covered with Tolkachev, and further discussions along those lines will only alienate him. Moreover, he said, if Tolkachev were told the request was still pending, it could lead to loss of this valuable asset. Do we want to risk this? He asked plaintively. Gilshar also reminded headquarters that Tolkachev had warned them in October not to play games with him and had threatened to quit. At the time, Tolkachev had written, "I understand perfectly that I will only be able to end my cooperation by committing suicide." Gilshar pointed out that he wouldn't need the CIA suicide pill to take his own life. It was a very tough message to headquarters, suggesting the operation could collapse and they might forever lose Tolkachev, both the man and the espionage operation, because of Turner's refusal to approve the suicide pill. Gilshar offered one last-ditch idea. In the next meeting, he said, he could tell Tolkachev that he should write a personal letter to the head of the CIA, appealing for the L pill. That would at least keep the special request alive. Beyond the suicide pill, Gilshar and Hathaway faced a troubling dilemma in January 1980. Tolkachev was producing extremely valuable intelligence, but taking too many risks. To improve his security, they might have to slow down his spying. That trade-off would be hard enough, but there was another factor. Any effort to slow down Tolkachev would collide with his personal desire to damage the Soviet Union as much as possible. They might not be able to slow him down. The Moscow station and headquarters wrestled with this knotty problem day after day. The library permission sheet was the biggest danger. If it was ever examined closely by the authorities, they would immediately spot the excessive number and scope of the documents Tolkachev signed out. On January 12th, headquarters told Gilshar and Hathaway, "We certainly share your deep concern about it. Unfortunately, the damage has been done, as the log sheets in the First Department are there for the checking." Headquarters suggested Tolkachev invent a cover story, however thin, for why he needed all the extra documents he had checked out. But the problem ran deeper than covering past actions. Tolkachev was taking more and more risks, including his daring ruse to spirit documents out of the Institute in December. On January 16th, headquarters acknowledged, "Clearly, we have to try to improve his security, slow him down." Headquarters suggested they withhold a replacement 35mm Pentax camera from Tolkachev so that he could not take any more documents home to photograph. This could alleviate some of the security concerns. He wouldn't be carrying top-secret papers out of the Institute. But it would also mean a loss of productivity. Tolkachev had already delivered to the CIA thousands of pages of valuable intelligence using the Pentax camera. Tolkachev, his enthusiasm undiminished, raised the prospect in his December note of a quick delivery of documents in January. Headquarters threw cold water on that idea, telling the Moscow station, "At all costs, we must avoid any hurried, possibly suspicious act like a quick delivery." Gilshar's instinct was that withholding the Pentax camera would be a mistake. He and Hathaway were convinced, he wrote to headquarters, "All our urging will go unheeded because nothing will deter Tolkachev from his goal of doing maximum damage in shortest time." In a flurry of messages, headquarters expressed concern that Tolkachev was heading toward disaster. Gilshar replied that they must break Tolkachev softly, without damaging his motivation, offending him, or having him lose faith in us. Aside from Tolkachev's immediate security risks, Gilshar had a nagging worry about a longer-term danger. As Tolkachev turned over more and more documents, additional military and intelligence experts in the United States would see them. Over time, the design of U.S. weapons would change, battle tactics would be revised, and countermeasures would be created. all based on what Tolkachev had provided. Gilsha wrote to headquarters, "It is not inconceivable word will eventually trickle back to Soviets that we are in possession of certain types of information. Investigation of possible leaks at Soviet end could quickly point finger at CK's fear." The first thing the Soviets would look at was the permission sheet with all Tolkachev's signatures on it. Gilsher felt squeezed and impatient. Headquarters wanted to reject Tolkachev's demands for the L-pill. Headquarters wanted to reject Tolkachev's request for the 35mm camera. Headquarters wanted to slow down the agent, who, if anything, was racing ahead. The CIA's miniature Tropel camera, while an ingenious feat of engineering, was not foolproof. In January, headquarters reported to the Moscow station that film from the black Tropel, which Tolkachev exposed in the fall, one of the two for testing, was unreadable. All the frames were underexposed, and precious intelligence was lost. The Tropel cameras required a minimum of 35 to 50 foot candles to get a clear photograph. Tolkachev told them he had taken special care in using the Tropels. He had fashioned a knitting needle on a small chain, hanging from his wrist, to help him judge the exact distance for good focus, and CIA analysts spotted the shadow of the knitting needle in his pictures. At home, where he could control the lighting, Tolkachev was still having difficulties. He said there was an ample 35 to 50 foot candles for the first 80 frames he had shot, and somewhat less for the other 40 frames. Yet the exposures from the black Tropel were unreadable. The CIA's technical experts had been working on an experimental, improved version with a wider lens opening that would work better in low light. But this was still being built, not in Tolkachev's hands. On January 28th, the Moscow station asked headquarters to send two Pentax 35mm camera bodies and a clean lens without delay. This time, headquarters said yes. The Moscow station held a going-away party for Hathaway in January, but he didn't like such festivities and excused himself to go to the industrialized paper shredder in the hall just outside the station. He was more than a paper shredder. It was a monster that turned documents to dust and could destroy them fast, just in case they ever had to get rid of everything suddenly. There, Hathaway stood in his final hours in Moscow, feeding documents into the rumbling, vibrating machine. His successor was an old friend, Burton Gerber, who had been among those ambitious officers who joined the CIA in the 1950s and pursued a more aggressive approach to espionage. Gerber subsequently served in Tehran, Sofia, and Belgrade, and developed the Gerber rules for vetting potential agents. Given these shifting rotations and promotions, Gerber wasn't sure if he would ever be in line for the coveted Moscow post. When the offer came, he eagerly accepted it. Chief of the most important station in the world. Gerber arrived in Moscow the third week of January 1980. He was a demanding boss, a no-frills and no-nonsense workaholic, known for pushing people hard and letting them know when something wasn't up to his standards. But he was also considerate of the hardships endured by officers and their families. Long hours, disappearances, and constant tension about surveillance and secrecy. Gerber knew by heart all the names of the wives and children of his case officers and asked about them, even as he drove his officers to work harder and longer. His lifelong hobby was the study of wolves, and he kept a picture of a wolf in his office. He also put up a photograph of Ren Krasilnikov, the chief of counterintelligence for the KGB. Gerber wanted to remind himself that Krasilnikov's presence was always out there, his men lurking on the streets. Gerber would have to defeat them. Instead of the sleek IBM Selectric typewriters used by some others in the station, Gerber brought an old manual typewriter, and he typed fast on it. He believed that case officers should know their city and know their targets. One officer in the station recalled that Gerber would occasionally buy propaganda picture cards of leading Communist Party members. then mischievously come up to case officers in the station and hold up a card. "Say you are on the street and you see this guy," he would ask a case officer. "Who is it?" Gilcher had been meeting Tolkachev for a year and acutely felt the burdens of keeping him safe and the operation alive. Getting ready for the next rendezvous, he drafted a very long ops note that he knew Tolkachev would read after they had parted. The letter allowed Gilcher to say more than was possible during a short encounter. Gilcher warned Tolkachev that the invasion of Afghanistan could prompt the KGB to tighten surveillance on the streets, and they might have to use dead drops to communicate, even though Tolkachev disliked dead drops. Gilcher reassured Tolkachev that the CIA would understand if he could not provide as many top-secret documents as before, at least for a while. "Please do not feel badly about this situation. Work quietly, and don't remove from the First Department those materials which are not connected to your work," he wrote. At the same time, Gilcher's letter conveyed an entirely different and unmistakable message. The United States was hungry, absolutely starving, for more of Tolkachev's valuable intelligence. Gilcher sketched out a wide array of secrets that Tolkachev might purloin. "We were very glad to receive from you electronic components," Gilcher said, asking Tolkachev for more, such as pieces of metal from airplanes and technical devices. "The alloys from which they build airplanes present a great interest," he wrote. "We will be very grateful." He added, "I remind you that we wish very much to receive telephone and other handbooks of the institutes, ministries, and other institutions with which your institute works." Gilcher said the CIA wanted to know about individuals and who goes abroad, if you know this. The CIA wanted to know what Soviet engineers had learned about American technology. "Please give details about which data, materials, and information were making their way to the Soviet Defense Industry Institutes." The CIA wanted Tolkachev to concentrate on more about future weapon systems, including the nascent Soviet effort to build an airborne warning and control system plane and a vertical takeoff and landing fighter, both then on the drawing boards. The CIA wanted to know about further new developments of systems in phases 1 through 5 of research and development. "And I remind you that we are interested in everything you know about civil defense, in your institute, and also in the country in general. Let's say, are there signs that more attention is now paid to civil defense?" The wish list went on and on. The CIA wanted to know everything possible about what was contained in the secret library in the institute, including how materials could be taken out, how the permission sheet worked, and how long the documents could be kept out. The CIA wanted to know what levels of secret documents were kept there, whether they concerned future or present weapon systems, and whether the library contained information on aviation and radars, materials that airplanes were built from, design of airplanes and rockets, lasers, direct energy research, aerosols, alloys, and special metals, airstrike tactics, electro-optics, tactics of forward air control and close air support, and command and control systems. The CIA wondered if Tolkachev could take a light meter reading in the secret library and maybe photograph several samples of the kinds of documents which you can logically remove for your work. Gilcher also was puzzling over a new idea for obtaining the secret documents. Under the new security procedure, Tolkachev was required to turn in his building pass while checking out secret documents from the First Department. This meant he could not leave the institute and smuggle the papers out of the building because he would not have a pass to come and go. But Tolkachev had come up with an idea. What if the CIA could fabricate a replica of his building pass? He could leave one pass with the First Department when he checked out documents and show the replica at the building entrance. Gilcher again wondered, what could go wrong? Would it look odd if Tolkachev had left his building pass at the First Department at the time of signing out documents, but was seen holding up an identical pass on leaving or entering the building a few minutes later? Could he get caught that way? Still, the idea of a fake building pass was appealing to the CIA. If successful, it would be a splendid act of deception in service of their most valuable agent. In the letter, Gilshar gave Tolkachev a fresh schedule for meetings over the next 12 months and new instructions for how to signal readiness for a meeting after a long pause. The instructions reflected the case officer's attention to detail. On the first day of any month, Tolkachev should make a mark at a certain site with that yellow wax pencil which I gave you. Such a mark will be more dependable than chalk, which can wash out or be erased. I remind you that the signal is a horizontal mark 10 centimeters long at waist height. On the evening of February 11, 1980, Gilshar set off on a long surveillance detection run. He arrived 20 minutes early at the site for his sixth meeting with Tolkachev, a spot near Leningradsky Prospect, a major thoroughfare that heads northwest out of the center of the metropolis. Gilshar circled around the site, casing it carefully. After Tolkachev showed up, they talked as they walked, crisply running down their agenda. Gilshar gave Tolkachev the two Pentax 35mm cameras. In exchange, Tolkachev passed back the four Tropel cameras, blue, gold, silver, and green, which he had used to photograph documents. Tolkachev also handed Gilshar a 9-page ops note. Tolkachev said that from now on, to confirm a meeting date, he would turn on the kitchen light in his apartment between noon and 2 p.m. The light was clearly visible from the street. They agreed to meet again in May. Gilshar warned Tolkachev of increased KGB surveillance. Tolkachev then asked about the suicide pill. Gilshar told him reluctantly that the special request had been turned down by headquarters. Tolkachev was shattered. He mumbled that this would be a major psychological blow to him. Gilshar saw that Tolkachev, who up to that point had stood erect and alert, suddenly changed. He looked crushed and spiritless. Gilshar immediately shifted gears. He urged Tolkachev to write a letter to the highest level in the United States, requesting a reconsideration. Gilshar then told Tolkachev that his tour was ending and he would be leaving Moscow in late summer. They parted after only 20 minutes. Gilshar walked away in the darkness, the Tropel spy cameras and letter in his pocket, brooding at the image of Tolkachev, crumpling before his eyes. The next morning, Gilshar arrived early in the Moscow station, and Gerber was waiting for him. Gilshar described how Tolkachev had nearly collapsed at the rejection of his request for a suicide pill. The reaction was even more severe than he had expected. In a cable to headquarters, Gilshar and Gerber reported that the agent has suffered a major psychological blow that will adversely affect the future of operation if we do not reverse decision. But there was little more they could do until Tolkachev wrote his appeal letter. They told headquarters the setback was made worse by Gilshar's request that Tolkachev limit his production and lie low, and by Gilshar's impending departure. Gilshar was the only face Tolkachev had known from the CIA for more than a year. Gilshar opened Tolkachev's ops note. It was businesslike and well-organized, with precise details about his use of the color-coded Tropels to photograph documents. Tolkachev numbered everything. For example, document RE10 was photographed with a gold camera. He also reminded the CIA that he was way out on a limb because of the long list of documents he'd taken out of the First Department. If there was a leak from the United States, he wrote, then my situation will become hopeless. Gilshar certainly agreed. In the note, Tolkachev returned to the contentious topic of money, but he was apologetic. He said there had been misunderstandings. My mistake. He acknowledged creating confusion when he started talking about a six-digit figure when I had in mind six zeros. Tolkachev explained that he was certain Belenko had received $6 million, and that had influenced his thinking, but he had never demanded a specific sum. He said he would let the CIA decide how much to pay him. based on the value of his espionage. His expectations for a large paycheck were still high. He asked the CIA to put his money in hard currency in an escrow account, as long as he could withdraw it at any time. Gilshier expressed sympathy with Tolkachev on the money question in a note to headquarters. "We can easily imagine the difficult position CKS finds himself in when negotiating due reward for his efforts," Gilshier wrote. "He obviously fears he will be taken advantage of, large government versus one helpless individual, when he has committed treason and already passed invaluable materials to us." Gilshier added that Tolkachev was still talking in terms of millions. That spring, the Air Force reported that Tolkachev's material had dovetailed with other intelligence on Soviet weapons systems, and much of the Tolkachev material was quite damaging to Moscow. The Air Force said Tolkachev had provided a wealth of science and technology information, and his primary value was providing a detailed picture of new Soviet weapon systems that would not be available from other sources for many years, if ever. In March, Gilshier and Gerber raised the question with headquarters of what Tolkachev was really worth. In a cable, they pointed out that previous evaluations from the military had been glowing. The evaluations had praised Tolkachev's materials as the first information about some weapons, as the only information, first hard information, and declared, "Time saved on research and development of U.S. countermeasures to these systems has been reduced by a minimum of 18 months, for one system as much as 5 years. Another called Tolkachev's intelligence a gold mine, and 180-degree change in $70 million project. Gilshier and Gerber inquired if the intelligence community could put a dollar value on it all. "For instance, how can we expect to save on R&D? Have we discovered vulnerabilities in our systems that we can now correct? Can we develop new countermeasures against Soviet systems? Do we have true picture of Soviet capabilities in field? Has CKS provided information on systems for which we had no data before?" The answer to all the questions was that Tolkachev had provided intelligence that was, as headquarters put it, essentially invaluable. Headquarters added, "We suspect C.K. Sphere himself, fully aware of the extraordinary value of his materials, realizes we cannot pay him the exact amount the production is worth, even if we could calculate it." Next, headquarters sent the Moscow station an internal CIA evaluation of Tolkachev's materials. The internal evaluation declared, "The timeliness of these reports is especially significant in terms of savings to the intelligence community. With other systems, such detail and understanding are not obtained until years after deployment. The definitive data in these reports will save many years of analysis and debate in the intelligence community." Although the 150,000 rubles that Gilshier had given Tolkachev in December 1979 quieted his anxiety, the CIA had never really settled on how much to pay him over the long haul. Tolkachev was waiting for their decision. In March 1980, Gerber wrote to Hathaway, now the Soviet division chief, saying that before the next meeting with Tolkachev, they would have to make some realistic plans for future and decide on commitments we will live up to. The Moscow station suggested a total compensation package of $3.2 million. It was still a tiny fraction of the value of Tolkachev's intelligence to the U.S. government, but much more than he had been given so far. Hathaway knew well how troublesome the question had become. He had wrestled with it himself as station chief. In early April, Hathaway responded, "The problem is basically one of not so much how much his information is worth, rather how much can he handle, and frankly, how much can we reasonably pay him. I say reasonably since if we took the total value of his information, we would frankly be talking about astronomical figures. I do not mean to be cruel, but we are not a business, and we can compensate him reasonably without paying the maximum. Hathaway also wanted to slow down Tolkachev. We here are obliged to do everything to slow him